The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. The information and ideas presented on this show are for informational purposes only. Please consult a business continuity, security, or disaster recovery professional before implementing any plans or ideas discussed on this show. The implementation of any protocol is at the sole discretion and responsibility of our listeners.
Is your business ready for a disaster, or are you prepared for anything? No matter the industry or structure of your organization, chances are there could be room for improvement regarding your survival business practices. This is Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. Your host is Pamela Hill. Join us today as we study what's working in business preparedness and what's still left to do. Here is Pamela Hill.
Hello and welcome to the show, everyone. This is Pam Hill, your host, and this is Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. Well, did you know that within 24 hours of the massive and highly publicized data breach at Target, the lawsuits were already being filed? Seems like we hear about data breaches constantly these days, and of course, the subsequent lawsuits. But have you ever wondered just how successful data security or privacy breaches really are, how these lawsuits are really actually coming out? Well, today we investigate the successes and roadblocks of data breach lawsuits with Darren Sands, attorney and shareholder with the law firm Lane Powell PC up in the great Pacific Northwest. Darren Sands is a Harvard-educated litigator whose practice focuses on complex commercial disputes. He's the co-chair of both the firm's Privacy and Data Security Practice Group and Electronic Discovery Technology and Strategy Practice Group. Darren represents clients in a wide range of matters, including class actions, international antitrust investigations and litigation, claims involving breach of contract and fiduciary duties, privacy and data security litigation, and counseling related to electronic discovery policies, protocols, and disputes. Darren is also a member of the firm's Business Crisis Management and Emergency Remedies Practice Group. So welcome to the show, Darren.
Thanks, Pam. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate you being here. As always in this show, we kind of start with an overview. So I'd like to talk about the data breach lawsuits kind of in general. First, what are the types of cases that are being litigated?
Well, you know, they arise from a number of different types of activities, a number of different types of data breaches, and then they take a number of different forms. So there's a lot of statistics out there, and because this is such a fast-moving area of the law, some of them are different than others. But one report that I read identifies that 35% of these data breach lawsuits arise from employee abuse of access. So these are situations where internal employees are accessing company data from within the company or stealing it or stealing hard copy documents, things like that. 22% arise from hacking situations. These are the sort of the traditional hacking situations that we read about in the news, such as with Target. And then about approximately 8% are from stolen or lost mobile devices. And then there's a combination for the rest, there's a sort of a combination of other issues related to privacy policies. And then assuming that a data breach has taken place, they can be brought by a number of different sources. So they can be brought by private individuals, so consumers. They can be brought by banks who are issuing the cards that are being compromised. They can arise from business entities who have contracts with companies who have suffered a data breach. They can come from state attorney generals. And also the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is increasingly active in this area. So, you know, it depends on the data breach, but they can come from a number of different sources.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the FTC because I went, what? When I saw that, it's just hard to get your mind around the Federal Trade Commission being right involved in these lawsuits, but we are going to talk about that later. So are these generally federal lawsuits, state lawsuits, or are they kind of a combination of both?
It's a combination of both. It depends on the size of the breach and the claims being brought by the plaintiffs. So typically, in order to get into federal court, It has to be of a class action would have to be of a certain size and involve a certain number of out-of-state actors. For it to arise in state court, all you need to do is allege a violation of a state law, and you can keep it in state court. And there are a number of strategic decisions that plaintiffs look at when deciding whether to bring them in state or federal court. But I think if you look at the general mix, it's fairly broad, though the larger cases tend to end up in federal court due to our class action rules.
Oh, okay. And we're going to talk again more later about class actions because that's a very significant component of all of this. So what percentage of known data breaches are actually litigated, actually get to this point?
And while this is a hotly debated area right now because I guess there are two questions first to ask. The first is how many data breaches are actually occurring? And it's hard to really get a sense of that number because both because companies often don't report data breaches for a number of reasons. But unfortunately, I think if you talk to law enforcement officials, what you'll hear is that a large number of data breaches that are occurring, companies aren't even aware of. And that can be because, as I talked about earlier, with employee access, sometimes employees stealing data aren't caught. It's hard to put a number on that, but it could be a significant percentage of the situations where employees are accessing data unauthorized in an unauthorized way that they aren't getting caught. With regard to hackers, what we're seeing is with overseas hackers in particular, they have very sophisticated methods, and one of their primary strategies is to avoid detection for obvious reasons. And so if you talk to FBI officials who specialize in cybersecurity, what they'll tell you is that the problem is much more substantial than many in the business community even have a sense of. I think that more sophisticated business entities who understand their risk are more aware of this, and those tend to congregate in the healthcare industry, in the financial services industry, in the defense industry, and sensitive government agencies are also aware of this. And then with lost and stolen devices, we do see litigation that arises from that when somebody, for instance, leaves an unencrypted hard drive in a cab, and then that data ends up being found by nefarious sources. But I think all organizations are struggling with finding ways to ensure that when situations like that happens, when employees lose a cell phone or bring data home in a hard drive and then misplace it, that they notify the corporation of that breach and then that the corporation knows how to handle that. But this is an educational process, and right now I still think we're pretty low on the learning curve. So I think that the larger sphere of how many data breaches are taking place is very large. The number of those data breaches that the companies are aware of is pretty small. And then within that group of data breaches that companies are aware of, the ones that are publicized, are even smaller. And as we'll talk about, I think, later, there are data breach notification laws, but those are only triggered in some situations. And there's a large incentive for a lot of companies to do everything they can to minimize the publicity around these data breaches for obvious reasons. So I think the Target situation brought a lot of awareness to this, especially when combined with the Neiman Marcus breach. And I think that as these news stories grow, there's going to be greater and greater urgency on the behalf of lawmakers, law enforcement, and the public to ensure that people are made aware of these breaches in a prompt fashion.
Right, absolutely. Now, are there any federal standards for data security and privacy? I've certainly seen them in various areas, you know, HIPAA and that kind of thing. But are there any standards across the board for data privacy and security?
Right, and what you've identified is the case. I mean, there are certain industries, the financial services industry, the healthcare industry, obviously with HIPAA, sometimes industries that contain that have data relating to minors are subject to special data security requirements. And some states, such as Massachusetts and California, are imposing higher data security requirements than other states, but as of right now, if you're just an average everyday company, figuring out which state's data privacy rules apply to you and which don't is very difficult because, you know, every state has different rules and most companies in the internet era operate in all 50 states. So there, in the wake of the Target breach, there's been a real push by a number of actors, retailers, banks, consumer groups, to try and have the federal government impose some sort of uniform guidelines, both with regard to data security requirements and with regard to data breach notification laws, so that both to ensure that there's a minimum standard that all companies must follow, but I think from the retailer's perspective, it's also getting a sense of some sort of predictability and what sort of standards they're meant to live up to in order to make sure they're fulfilling their obligations. But the challenge that lawmakers are running into, and I think a challenge that retailers of and all businesses are running into, is that reasonable security steps is a very much a moving target. As data systems get more complex and hackers get more sophisticated, trying to set one static set of security requirements is almost destined to be a failure because it's going to be out of date almost instantaneously. So,
good point.
Yeah, so it's a challenge for everybody, and it's obviously a challenge for consumers because consumers want to know, you know, they can't investigate every company they keep their data with to ensure that they're meeting data security requirements that will protect their information. But until we think of different ways to secure our data that aren't as vulnerable to hackers, if that's even possible, I think it's going to continue to be a very ambiguous area of law. But I do think the federal government will be stepping in for at least some data breach notification laws because I think companies are really straining under the requirements of trying to meet all 50 states' requirements as well.
Yeah, and I think that explanation, you know, because I do a lot of HIPAA work, that explanation actually makes it the reason that, to my mind, HIPAA is so general. You know, for a long, long time, have been hoping that somebody would come up with something specific. Tell us what to do on the technology side. And the fact that it's still so nonspecific, to my mind, telling people exactly what they have to do, it just everything you're saying just makes that make so much more sense. We only have about 2 minutes to break, but can you just briefly explain what happened to Target, at least what they know now?
Well, you know, this is also very much a moving target, no pun intended. What happened originally was that Target, and when it first announced its breach, wasn't really fully aware of the scope of the breach. I mean, what happens in many of these cases, and cases that are far less sophisticated than the Target attack, is that the companies have to bring in forensics companies to recreate the attack and figure out what was accessed. And in Target's case, you know, they initially thought that the breach was far less substantial than it was, and they had to revise their public notification to indicate that PIN numbers may have been compromised. And some of the speculation, at least in the security world right now, it hasn't been confirmed by law enforcement, is that Target may have been infiltrated by actually its HVAC vendor who was in charge of monitoring power efforts overnight at the stores and things like that, and that they may have had access to the computer systems, and that that may have been the weakness that allowed the hackers to infiltrate Target systems, which is shocking.
They're heating and ventilation contractors.
Right,
oh, my God, you can't trust anybody.
Right. And it's a reminder that, you know, hackers, I think the typical view we have is that hackers are going to infiltrate you either by penetrating your network security or through phishing scams. But I think that a big vulnerability when companies focus too much on these external threats is that you don't look behind your own firewall or look within your own systems to see where the weaknesses are. Because I think every company in America, including law firms, including healthcare companies, you know, has a wide range of people who have access to their office buildings, including vendors.
Yeah, and that's the one thing nobody wants to put. Yeah, they don't want to put controls around them either.
Yeah, so. Right. And so it's important to remember that threats are as it can be as big from the inside as they are from the outside. So,
Ryan, absolutely. Well said. We need to go to break right now, Darren. And when we come back, I'd like to actually talk about the lawsuits themselves. You know, what are the plaintiffs actually seeking relief for? So this is Pam Hill. I'm here with Darren Sands. This is Fair is Negotiable, and we will be right back.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
From disasters to cyber threats, it's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back to the show, everyone. This is Pam Hill. I'm here with Darren Sands, and we're talking about data breach lawsuits. So, Darren, my next question is, what are the plaintiffs actually seeking relief for in general? Is it emotional distress, time they spent at their bank trying to get their credit cards shut down? I mean, what is it they're suing for?
Yeah, and this is actually a hot point of debate within the legal community, because when these data breach lawsuits first started in class action context, and we're talking about consumer class actions, I guess, right now, is that they were seeking a wide range of relief, everything from the cost of replacing their card to emotional distress to future threat of identity theft to cost of credit monitoring, lost wages due to emotional distress, things like that. And courts have repeatedly ruled in defendants' favor on a lot of these issues, finding that the only thing that plaintiffs can recover for in these lawsuits are actual losses that can be directly tied to the data breach. And what courts have typically found meets that standard are things that are called mitigation expenses. So usually that takes the part takes the form of the costs related to replacing your debit card, and those are very limited. So these are, of course, class action cases. So in many situations, those can add up to a substantial sum of money, but individual consumers end up walking away with very little. One new theory that plaintiffs have been pursuing, sometimes successfully, sometimes not successfully, is to attribute a certain portion of a value of a contract. So if, for instance, in the LinkedIn litigation, when LinkedIn had a data breach and lost information, plaintiffs allege that a certain portion of the value for premium users, so premium users pay something like $30 a month, plaintiffs were arguing that a portion of that, let's say $2, was attributable to consumers paying for higher security standards, as were reflected in LinkedIn's privacy policy. The court ultimately rejected that in the LinkedIn litigation and said that you couldn't attribute the value to privacy standards without a more direct link. But in a recent settlement in federal court in Florida against AvMed, which was a medical company, that was one of the first cases. This case settled just in November of last year, and in that case, a $3 million pool, settlement pool was created that allowed consumers who had been paying premiums to AvMed, was an insurance company, to recover a certain portion of those premiums. I think it was something like $10 a month or something like that for every year, or $10 a year for every year they had the policy. So you see plaintiffs trying to get more creative with tying it themselves to direct damages, but when you start talking about things like the risk of future credit harm and costs of credit reporting, courts have been very skeptical of that, and those efforts have been largely unsuccessful. The other issue, frankly, is a question of causation, and by causation I mean, you know, if Target, for instance, has a data breach, and you use your card at Target in December, and in February you have a fraudulent charge in, let's say, Latvia or something like that, your ability to connect the Target data breach to your fraudulent charge in Latvia is almost impossible. And the reason for that is your credit card data is stored in so many places, and in order to establish that the criminals in Latvia were using the data they obtained from Target is almost impossible. So plaintiffs are running into that problem as well. More successful are banks. So banks, you see a number of the Target lawsuits that sprung up relate to claims brought by banks. And banks have obviously more direct charges because they're reimbursing their customers for fraudulent charges. And in the past, they were, I think, reluctant to bring lawsuits because they didn't want to draw attention to the fact that their cards were the subject of data breaches. But once you move into cases that are the size of Target and where the losses on the bank side are so substantial, their motivation to file lawsuits increases. And then, of course, there's the FTC and things like that, which we'll get to. But generally, I think the moral of the story is that plaintiffs have been largely unsuccessful in recovering substantial damages, though plaintiffs' lawyers representing them have been able to still make out with a substantial amount of fees.
I would imagine, yeah. So what exactly are the businesses with data breaches actually being sued for? Is it how quickly they notify people, willful neglect of maintaining privacy? What is it they're being sued for?
And that's also an interesting question. I think there's three main areas that form the basis of these lawsuits. The first is a failure to maintain, well, let's just call them reasonable security standards. So these are security standards that aren't defined in any privacy policy, but it's a negligence theory, and basically it says that if I'm a retailer, I have a basic duty of care to maintain reasonable security policies to protect my customers' information. The question of what a reasonable security measure is obviously something that is hotly debated, but that's probably the foundation of most plaintiffs' lawsuits, and that's also, at the end of the day, the basis for when the government, either it's state attorney generals or FTC, steps in. That's sort of the fundamental basis of those claims. A second type of claim arises when companies' stated data security and privacy policies differ from their actual stated privacy and data security policies. And as somebody who counsels clients on these issues, this is, I think, perhaps a very much an underestimated source of risk for companies, because I think in this era, the urge is to assure your customers that you're taking all reasonable steps. But once you start making specific promises about the steps that you're taking, you have to make sure that you're following through with those promises, because in the event of a data breach, if you're not living up to the promises you're making to the public, you really open yourself up to a standard of care that you may not have been subject to absent making those promises. So that's a situation where companies have to be very careful to make sure that their legal, IT, and security departments are all on the same page. And then the third area of lawsuit arises from companies failing to meet state data breach notification laws. So HIPAA has data breach notification periods. 46 states have data breach notification periods. So a lot of companies find themselves, for a number of reasons, not responding and notifying customers within those time limits. It's unclear what damages arise, but plaintiffs have looked to that as an area of identifying claims as well.
Interesting. So I want to talk about the Wyndham Hotel in the case of the data breach there last year. The FTC actually sued under Section 5, which is the unfair or deceptive acts or practices. To whom does this apply and how does it relate to data breaches? Because I read it and I couldn't even wrap my head around how that applied to data breaches.
Right. So
I'm not an attorney, but I can read.
Under Section 5 of the FTC Act, they do have the ability to regulate unfair and deceptive trade practices. And so the way the data breaches have been shoehorned into that is through unfair, the FTC tends to use the unfair prong to go after a failure to maintain basic minimum security standards. And the deceptive prong is used to go after companies who are promising one thing on data security and delivering another. The FTC has been very aggressive in using this authority that they claim they have. And for a period of time, companies obviously facing the threat of FTC enforcement have erred on the side of settling with the FTC. But what we've seen in recent years is a couple high-profile efforts to really push back against whether the FTC even has the ability to bring these claims. And Wyndham is the most high-profile example of that. And Wyndham is challenging the FTC's ability to bring these claims on a number of different levels. And a number of legal commentators believe that they have a fairly strong argument to say that Congress wants the FTC to enforce data security laws, then they have to pass a law that says so. And they haven't done so. And so we'll see it work its way through the courts to see how that plays out. But it will be interesting to see because I think the FTC is probably driving a lot of the concern far more than even private plaintiffs, because FTC has taken even a broader view of standards of practice and are more successful in enforcing those than private plaintiffs have been. And I would expect for us to get some sort of resolution on that front in the coming year, either through the Wyndham case, where we'll eventually get a court decision, or through Congress taking action. And I mentioned earlier that the Target breach has sort of spurred Congress into taking action. And as part of that, one part of the debate is how much should the FTC be charged with enforcing these standards, or how much should they not be charged with enforcing those standards? And that's a debate that will play out in the coming year as well.
Yeah, interesting. We only have a couple of minutes before we have to go to break, but can you also explain the Fair Credit Reporting Act is actually the second most common cause of action in these types of lawsuits. What are the components of that, and how does it relate again to data breach lawsuits?
Right. I mean, this is a little bit, in my mind, it's one of the more tangential ways of bringing these claims, but it's attractive to plaintiffs because it provides for a number of forms of relief that they otherwise wouldn't get. And often in these cases, you see plaintiffs throwing everything sort of and the kitchen sink against the wall and hoping that something sticks. I mean, my understanding is that the Fair Credit Reporting Act claims arise in the situation where consumers' credit reports are stored by certain companies. And if those credit reports are then the subject of a data breach, plaintiffs have argued that those breaches are in violation of the Fair Credit Reporting Act because they failed to establish adequate procedures to furnish consumer reports in a proper way. That claim has been rejected by most courts. There was just a case in the Northern District of Georgia in federal court in 2013 where the court rejected that and said essentially that if something's stolen from a company, that doesn't fall under the umbrella of whether a company has followed procedures in releasing a consumer report. And I think that's probably the better side of the argument. I don't think plaintiffs are going to get a lot of momentum or leverage in using Fair Credit Reporting Act in these lawsuits in the future.
Interesting, but they keep doing it, of course.
They're hoping for a court will accept it, and that's all you need is one court often.
Exactly. We need to go to break now, Darren. This is Pam Hill. I'm here with Darren Sands from Lane Powell PC, and we will be right back.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. From disasters to cyber threats, it's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. Now, back to the program.
Hey, welcome back to the show, everyone. This is Pam Hill. I'm here with Darren Sands from Lane Powell, PC. It's a law firm in the Pacific Northwest, and we're talking about data breach lawsuits. So I'm kind of curious, Darren, to get into the kind of the mire of this. What types of cases are more likely to settle and why?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the total number of data breach lawsuits, and by data breach lawsuits, I mean the sort that we've been talking about where either a hacker has penetrated consumer data on a company's servers or where an employee at a company has stolen data or lost data. Of those cases, a grand total of zero have actually gone to trial. And so I guess the direct answer to your question is all of them settle in one way or another, or they're dismissed. And how these usually play out, and again, it depends on the parties, because I think that banks and companies, for instance, are much more likely to settle behind the scenes, because there's neither party has a real incentive to make a public fight about security breaches that make consumers less confident in both of their offerings. But when it comes to consumer class actions, and that's the primary form of litigation that these data breach lawsuits take the form of, in those situations, what you often see determining the size of the settlement or the timing of the settlement is the court's ruling on the pure legal questions of whether a cause of action exists. And those questions come back to what we just discussed, which is whether or not the consumer has suffered any direct harm. And so if you have a situation like in the LinkedIn litigation where LinkedIn lost personal data, but it was very hard for the plaintiffs in that action to establish any form of actual damages that weren't speculative. So they could speculate that losing their data would lead to security breaches down the line or impact on their credit report. But without having an actual harm, such as when a consumer has to replace their card and it costs $20, there's some actual harm. But if they don't have that actual harm and the court dismisses the claims, then usually plaintiffs will walk away. If they're able, on the other hand, to establish some sort of harm, whether by proving that some portion of the fees they were paying to the company that suffered the data breach were tied to a promise about data security or some other direct harm, in those situations, once the court rules that they have a viable cause of action, and that's through the form of a motion to dismiss, once that the court rules that a claim exists, usually the parties and historically have reached agreements in those cases. So in the few cases, the AvMed case that I discussed earlier, in those sorts of cases, you get settlements fairly quickly after the court's determinations. And those settlements haven't been huge, but they also haven't been small. In the AvMed case, I think it was somewhere north of $3 million.
Wow. Now, does the way in which the data were breached actually play a role in the final disposition? So it's settled, it's dismissed. Does that actually play a role? And by the way, I mean like cyber attack versus, I accidentally threw out a CD that had a whole bunch of PII on it.
Right. And I do think it matters. And the reason that it matters is I think that a plaintiff is far more likely to be, once assuming that they can get past this damages issue, a court's far more likely to rule against a defendant in these situations if the security failure is more egregious. So in the situations where you have the AvMed case, for example, involved a situation where an employee of an insurance company had unencrypted hard drives that they left in a cab that contained patient information, protected information. In a situation like that, I think that plaintiffs can make a fairly strong argument that a healthcare company should not be, should at a bare minimum be only providing its employees with encrypted hard drives, and that it should have a very strong policy about what happens when hardware is lost. And if you aren't able to show that, then I think a court's more willing to do it. And on the flip side, if you're someone like Target, and you're in a situation where I don't know the details, but I assume Target had fairly substantial security policies in place that were nevertheless breached by very sophisticated hackers, I think you have a situation where a company can argue that just because it's been the subject of a hacking attack does not mean that it should be liable for damages, that it's taken reasonable steps, and that there are some situations where sophisticated hackers will be able to penetrate not just reasonable security measures, but very substantial security measures. And, I think just a real-world example of this is the Edward Snowden case, and that's a situation where the NSA, which I think we would all agree is a organization that is
got a little security,
found itself losing huge quantities of its most valuable material to a vendor who was able to use apparently fairly simple techniques to undertake a very substantial security breach. So I think defendants in that situation have a pretty good argument that just because you're the victim of a data breach doesn't mean that you should be paying out millions and millions of dollars in damages.
I want to talk about Target again just for a second since you brought it up. I mentioned this earlier, within 24 hours of the breach going public, the lawsuits were already being filed. And what I can't get my head around is, how did they get filed so fast? We didn't know the cause of the breach, the extent of the breach, didn't know when notification had been made, when they actually knew that there was a breach. How can something be successful this early? Does the early bird really get the worm in this case?
The world of plaintiff's class action lawyer politics is very interesting, but there are some very good plaintiff's firms out there who are able to very quickly research these issues and put together complaints using publicly available information, available information that comes from law enforcement, but also publicly available information that goes back in time. So one of the leading lawsuits against Target has been brought by a plaintiff's firm called Hoggins Berman, which is a very well-respected plaintiff's firm in Seattle, that's based in Seattle. And my understanding is that they are basing their complaint based on a 2007 report from an expert that warned a number of retailers, including Target, and this is the allegation, I'm not validating it, but that this expert warned Target and other retailers of the potential security vulnerabilities they had, and that Target was aware of this report and had circulated it and failed to take appropriate actions. Oftentimes what plaintiff's attorneys will do in this situation is file lawsuits with as much publicly available information as they can, and then go to the court and say, obviously defendants in this situation have access to far more information about this as possible, and we should have the opportunity to conduct discovery to find out the exact situation of the breach and to fill out our allegations more at that point. And some courts are more sympathetic to that than others, but that's the primary strategy. So most of the time you see a sort of a race to the courthouse where plaintiffs' attorneys attempt to file lawsuits very quickly and then get as many people on their side as possible and then make an effort for the court to appoint them as lead counsel in these cases. And how that happens determines how much fees they recover. So that's a complicated question, but I think plaintiffs have gotten more and more sophisticated about finding out information very quickly about situations like this.
Very, very interesting. How successful have companies with cyber insurance been in getting the insurance companies to pay claim? We did a whole show, by the way, on cyber insurance, and I'm really kind of curious that now that there have actually been, you know, lawsuits that have settled.
Yeah, you know, and I'm not an insurance lawyer, but I can tell you that we, you know, from my colleagues in at Lane Powell, who are very sophisticated about these questions, what I've heard from them is that I think a lot of companies are going out into the marketplace and attempting to get cyber liability insurance because obviously the cost of these breaches can be very substantial. I think that the Navigant Consulting put out a study, and the average size of the cost of a data breach, depending on what industry it is, could range anywhere from $1 million to $20 million. So, you know, businesses are aware of that and are trying to insure themselves. But, you know, what I advise, you know, my clients or people who have just asked me generally about this is to make sure that you work with legal counsel who are, you know, sophisticated about these policies, because what we're finding is a lot of people are buying cyber insurance policies without really knowing how those policies play out in the event of a breach and in what types of breaches trigger the coverage and things like that. So it's just really important to be careful, to be sophisticated when you purchase this. It's certainly something that I would advise all companies who have vulnerability and who store customer or health or financial information, investigate. But it's also a procedure that oftentimes requires making sure that your security policies are up to par, and the insurance companies will require that. So it's a pretty big effort, and I think that companies shouldn't take it lightly, that they should engage with competent legal counsel and quality insurance brokers and things like that, and quality IT security people to ensure that when they go into that situation, they're not just insuring against a breach, but taking as many steps as possible to avoid a breach at the same time.
Yeah, that's a very, very important point. And I would think as well, this goes back to a point you made earlier, that if you've written a policy, you had better be sticking to it, because I would imagine that if you have insurance and you've said to the insurance company you're going to do one thing and you're not doing it, that is going to be a major, major problem if you actually have a breach.
That's right, yeah. And it's again, this is all about, at the end of the day, what it comes down to in my mind is I think that these security issues have been sort of siloed into either the IT department or the company's security department. And in the modern world, it really requires a coordinated effort between legal advisors, technical advisors, security advisors, and support of the C-suite to ensure that all of those departments are working together, because it's much better to be in a proactive situation dealing with these threats than in a reactive situation. And so many times companies don't start to put into place really thoughtful security procedures, data security procedures, until a breach has taken place. And at that point, the damage is already done, both from the bottom line perspective, but also from a reputational perspective.
Absolutely. Very important. Darren, we have to go to a break now. When we come back, I'd like to talk specifically about HIPAA and healthcare breaches, because those are some that make it into the news, you know, pretty extensively as well. So this is Pam Hill. I'm here with Darren Sands from Lane Powell Law Firm, and we'll be right back.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network by keeping up with us on Twitter. You can find us at Voice America TRN.
from disasters to cyber threats. It's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. Now, back to the program.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. This is Pam Hill. I'm here with Darren Sands, and we are talking about data breach lawsuits. Darren, I'd like to talk now about HIPAA and healthcare breaches. I read the HITRUST survey for 2012 for the larger data breaches, which means over 500 individuals. And they had a lot of great information about, specifically about healthcare. And this seems to me where you would actually be able to show harm, because if you, like a famous person, you certainly don't want to get your medical records getting out. But how do breaches of medical records generally occur? What did they find?
So in the HITRUST report, the breakdown was basically that the leading cause of data breaches was theft, so 54%. That's through the form of stolen laptops, desktops, mobile media, USB drives. And then the other breaches occur through, I think, probably the typical hacking routines. But, Navigant Consulting, again, they do a sort of overall view of the state of play in the data breach world. And their latest report from November of 2013 identified that in the second quarter of 2013, that 52% of all data breaches took place in the healthcare arena, which was substantially larger than any other. Second place was corporate non-healthcare, which was only 19%. So you see a huge focus on the healthcare industry. I was at a panel a few months ago discussing cybersecurity and risk, and there was an attorney for a large Florida healthcare provider, and they were talking about situations where street gangs in Miami had been caught by police with large quantities of healthcare information in their vehicles, and the source of that was, again, internal employees who are stealing this, and then it goes into the black market, and a lot of organized crime organizations are trafficking in this sort of data. And the attacks can come from overseas, they can come domestically, but healthcare is right in the center of the target for a lot of organizations.
Sure sounds like it. So who's most likely to have these types of breaches? Is it hospitals, business associates?
Yeah, so hospitals and physicians' practices were responsible for 32% and 28% of the total breaches, respectively. So you see that the breakdown in that situation is overwhelmingly focused on hospitals. But those breaches aren't limited to hospitals. Obviously, they can take place throughout the organization, throughout the healthcare sort of chain of command. But those are the most likely places to be the source of the breach. But nobody's really immune on the healthcare world.
Now, what about government agencies? I was actually kind of surprised to see that actually quite a lot of the breaches relate to government agencies. And I got to wonder, I don't know why the Affordable Care Act, why you would have PHI there, but I just got to wonder, they're playing a bigger role in healthcare in America now. And is this going to get worse?
Well, I mean, even if you just look at, for instance, the VA, VA is obviously a huge source of, contains a ton of healthcare personal information. And this was an interesting tension, again, at this cybersecurity conference I went to, sponsored by the Sedona conference, is that the FTC is enforcing very strict data security policies against private corporations, but we continually see government organizations elsewhere in government falling victim to these situations where either agencies are the subject of hacking or they're losing hard drives with personal identifiable information on it. And I think you're right that in this data-driven world that as the federal government and state governments take a larger role in healthcare and begin to hold on to lots and lots of amounts of data that takes the form of personal identifiable healthcare information, that these threats are just going to get worse and worse. And I don't think it's necessarily that the federal government's worse than anybody else, but just by virtue of their size and their reach into the healthcare industry, that we're going to see a number of high-profile breaches involving government officials as well.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Now, so there was another study. Kind of find out there are a lot of studies around HIPAA and healthcare data breaches. Kind of interesting. That 57% of healthcare entities responding to the survey said they had little or no confidence in their ability to detect all data loss or theft. With the big push to move to electronic medical records, thoughts on why that is? I mean, this is really a scary, that's a statistically significant number.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a situation where I do think that the HIPAA requirements around data security have helped raise awareness. And I think there are sort of three phases of that. I think there was a large period of ignorance where people just didn't know the threat existed. And then I think there is now a period where people, because of a number of different factors, are more aware of the threat. And as you start to dig in and try and develop policies to avoid being subject to those threats, you realize just how pervasive the threats are and how difficult they are to repel. I think that there are a lot of healthcare companies who are very successful at instituting very rigorous security requirements, and I think that's actually the majority, especially now, especially companies that are working with sophisticated IT partners and law firms who are aware of these threats. And over time, I do think that these healthcare providers will get better and better at this. I think it's just a question of developing the procedures and mechanisms to institute them in a way that people feel comfortable with. But right now we're still in a world, not just in the healthcare world, but everywhere, where the threat is changing and moving so quickly that I think that even companies who are doing everything they reasonably can are still a little bit concerned that they're not doing enough. And that's just because this threat changes so quickly. And the people who are on the other side of these threats, the people who are launching them, have a lot of incentive and time and money to construct increasingly complex means of attacking people's security systems. That's not to say it can't be done, but I think that for a lot of healthcare providers, they're just justifiably on alert. And as you're aware of the threat, I think it makes you nervous. But I think the good healthcare providers out there are making that sort of anxiety is making them more vigilant and making sure that they stay up on the most modern data security techniques and really tracking the threats in ways that people weren't 5 years ago.
Yeah, and I think I'd read, just to give them a little bit of a break here, that it takes, what, between the average business, 18 months to even figure out that a breach has really occurred for all the reasons we've been talking about today. So I don't think that this is unique to healthcare.
Oh, no. Yeah, I mean, that's the number one problem. And if you talk to anybody in law enforcement, a lot of these hacking attacks are very sophisticated, and they are number one on their strategy is making sure that they aren't detected. And even when the case of Target, even in the case of Neiman Marcus, these are retailers with very high profile, or who are very high profile targets and have very sophisticated internal IT security departments, weren't able to detect the threat. And, you know, and obviously the NSA, again, coming back to that, I mean, they weren't even aware of the breach until it was made public. So, yes, it's a very difficult
that's a really
world
important
to be working
point.
In right now.
Yes. Well, thanks for joining us today, Darren. Really enjoyed the talk. Tell people how they can get a hold of you.
So my name is Darren Sands again, and you can find me at www.lanepowell.com. My email address is sandsd@lanepowell.com, and we have a privacy and data security practice group, and we have a webpage affiliated with that, which you can find at lanepowell.com.
Well, thanks again, Darren, and thanks everyone for listening. Next week, the great friend of the show, Mike Schlosser, is going to from the Illinois Police Training Institute will be guest hosting for me. He'll be talking about emergency preparedness through mental and physical wellness. Until then, remember that fear is negotiable, but only through training, planning, and preparation. There is no other way. So until next week, safe travels, everyone.
Thank you for joining us this week for Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. We hope you'll tune in again next Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time for another edition with host Pamela Hill on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll identify more of the best practices in business survival then.
The information and ideas presented on this show are for informational purposes only. Please consult a business continuity, security, or disaster recovery professional before implementing any plans or ideas discussed on this show. The implementation of any protocol is at the sole discretion and responsibility of our listeners.